G'day, humans. Welcome to the show that goes where others don't. The show that rejects partisan squabbling and tribal groupthink. I'm Josh Zepps. I'm your humble warrior princess, hunting down the world's most fascinating minds to wrestle with one provocative question each week. Much of modern culture and politics and media is tailor-made, especially social media, tailor-made to pander to what we already believe and distort what we don't, to reinforce our biases and exaggerate our differences. But change doesn't happen in an echo chamber. It's time to leave the mental comfort zone, to flex our minds and step on some landmines, folks. It's time to have uncomfortable conversations. This week on the show, it's like drinking from a cool stream, delving into the mind of one of Australia's greatest novelists, Charlotte Wood. You may have heard of the book The Weekend. It exploded onto the scene in 2019 and was the read of the summer in Australia. Charlotte is still fairly young. She's only written six novels. I mean, she's in her 50s, but, you know, it's not like she's the grand dame of Australian literature, but she's been shortlisted for Australia's biggest book awards, like the Miles Franklin Award and the Stella Prize. I first encountered her actually at the beginning of the pandemic when I was broadcasting on ABC Radio, and she wrote a beautiful piece about the trap of feeling busy and distracted all the time. And that resonated with me. I had her on the air and I thought, wow, who is this chick? I didn't say chick. Who is this broad? I said, who is this fancy lady? I said to myself. And then I thought, I've got to get it back on the podcast, especially since she has a brand new book, not a novel this time, but a nonfiction book that deals with all of the kinds of things that I was speaking with her about last year. It's called The Luminous Solution, Creativity, Resilience, and the Inner Life. And my goodness, it was just lovely to have this conversation at a time in my life where I'm stressed out about the lockdown. We are all in Australia, well, in Sydney and Melbourne anyway, and Canberra, out of our minds about the lockdown, looking forward to the end of it, limping towards it. And I don't know about you, but I've found that one of my coping mechanisms throughout the lockdown and the pandemic in its entirety, in fact, has been to find myself coming back to the easy distractions of social media. And so my head hasn't been in a very good place. I'm negotiating a difficult contract about another work thing that's come up. I'm struggling with trying to figure out if I'm going to be able to take my kids to see their grandparents in the States anytime in the human scale future rather than geological time future. And to talk to Charlotte was just a reframing, a retweaking, a recognition that there's more to life than distractedness and worry. There is a deep well of creativity and insight if we just choose to take time to tap it. I hope this does as much for you as it did for me. Enjoy this conversation with Charlotte Wood. Tell us about The Luminous Solution and what and what inspired this book.
Well, it is a book about the creative process, basically just from my point of view, the way that my own creative impulse has worked and sort of developed over a number of years. And lots of the book has sort of started life as pieces published in different magazines and newspapers over the last sort of 20 years. And I'd often been invited to, you know, my publisher would say, why don't you get a collection of, you know, stuff that you've written and put it together? But I didn't want to put together a collection of, you know, just sort of selected writings. Mm. I wanted there to be a more cohesive kind of feeling about it. And then last year, the beginning of last year, and I think I might have even spoken to you about this, I published a piece called Fertile Ground about sort of what the inner life means and how to nourish it and what might threaten it and so on. And that was in the beginning of the pandemic when I was really kind of flipping out like everybody about what was going to happen and so on. And so I was in this sort of sense of panic and disarray, and I realized that I just had to stop and go quiet and just sort of go back into my imaginative inner world in the way that I always do when I'm working, but I'd sort of lost sight of it in all the panic about COVID. So I published that piece sort of asking, what is the inner life? Why is it important? Why do we need it? And how to, you know, enhance it, for want of a better word. And after I published that piece, I got so many, you know, emails and messages and things from people who were not artists or, you know, writers or whatever, but who felt really, they really connected with what I'd said in there about just attending to your inner world as an important thing rather than always turning to the exterior world to be happy, basically. So after that, I thought, well, maybe it's time for a collection that does bring some of the pieces I've written over the years together, the stuff about making art and what it means and the creative impulse, I guess. And then when I brought all these pieces together, quite a lot of them, I thought, actually, I don't think that anymore. I'm going to rewrite. So it's sort of most of them are either completely rewritten or sort of highly edited and changed. And then a couple of them haven't been published at all before, and a couple of the very recent ones sort of remain almost the same. But some of them are kind of enlarged, and I've just found I had more to say on certain things.
And what is the answer to sort of giving expression to the creative impulse? I mean, I suppose there's not one answer, but I feel like everybody, even people who think they're not creative, have a creative spark in them. Very few people find a way to channel that creative spark into a career as creative as writing novels. What's the difference?
Yeah, well, I think the main thing is just to understand that you want a sense of creativity in your life, and it doesn't mean that you have to be an artist of any kind, you know. And I think I say somewhere in the preface that if you live your life with curiosity and intention, that's what an inner life is, you know, and that's what a sense of creativity is. But if you do, you know, if you sort of have a nudging, niggling feeling that you could have a greater, you could pay more attention to your inner world, it's almost that's all you have to do is realize that that's what you want. And then you have to kind of just be conscious of how you spend your time, what sort of things you're putting into your mind. And a big part of it is just allowing a sense of stillness. A sense of stillness and quiet is something that is really important for nourishing a kind of rich inner world. But we are really quite frightened of stillness and quiet, I think. So we find ourselves just cramming stuff in, you know, like we binge on Netflix and we listen to, you know, podcasts, and we, even when we're going for a walk, we tend to, you know, have our ears filled with, you know, great stuff. But that sense of emptying out the mind in order to let other things come into it without sort of jamming stuff into it all the time is something that I realized in writing that piece. You know, it has to be really practiced, and it can be scary to go into a very quiet space.
Well, we also have devices now that are not just interesting but are designed to be addictively interesting by the world's greatest psychological manipulators in Silicon Valley. So I mean, I'm getting to a point at which I'm in a real pickle with my relationship to devices, especially in this most recent lockdown in Sydney, where it's really hard to muster the will to not keep scratching the itch of distraction by jumping onto Twitter or Facebook or Instagram or something. And I mean, I remember, you're right, you and I spoke, and I had no idea when this was. It actually surprised me to look it up and that it was April of 2020. that I was on ABC Radio and spoke with you about distractedness and busyness in the context of just beginning to emerge from the first pandemic lockdown. And I wonder whether you think that this stretch of time has been better or worse. Let's just talk about you for a second, and then we can talk about everybody. Better or worse for you at being able to find that stillness?
Do you mean this second lockdown or the whole time?
The whole pandemic.
Look, I have found it really hard because I'm the same as you. The distraction, the daily, especially once we're in lockdown, the daily thing of the numbers and watching the press conferences and all that sort of stuff, which, you know, logically it makes no difference if I watch it or not. Makes no difference to anyone but me, and it usually is detrimental.
It doesn't even really matter what the numbers are, actually. Once they're above a few hundred, you know that you're not putting the genie back in the bottle. I started telling people not to pay attention to the daily case numbers because we're all on this train and coronavirus will become endemic and we just have to get vaccinated and then that'll be that, and case numbers won't matter anymore, so stop caring about them.
That's right. Well, in the beginning there was a sense of, well, I should pay attention because, you know, see where the cases are. I live in an area where there's been, you know, quite a lot of cases here and there. So, you know, being responsible and going, oh, was I in that shop at that time, blah, blah. But I realised that my sense of sort of calm was returning when I forgot to check the numbers, you know. And really that sense of calm only came when I returned to work. And by work I mean writing fiction. Because that's where I can go into this sort of state of total absorption, and you know, it's an imagined world where the more I do it, the easier it is. And during the pandemic lockdown, I too easily left it. So it's still, after, you know, 20 something years, 30 years of writing books, I still have to practice drawing those boundaries of space and time around the time that I want to spend in my imagination. Because the whole contemporary world is built, as you say, and especially the technological world, its purpose is to destroy your inner world, really. Its purpose is to fill it up, distract you, make you buy things to make yourself feel better. So, and, you know, I'm absolutely prey to all that stuff as anybody else. But I know that once I calm down, put the phone away, turn it off, put the, you know, internet blocker on my, put the Facebook blocker on my computer, so I can't do that. I deleted my Twitter account some years ago, and I'm really glad I did. I do have Instagram, and I can be quite compulsive about it, and I'm very easily addicted to technological stuff. But I've learned the only way to actually, if I'm going to write books, I have to get control of that stuff, because it just doesn't work while writing and then checking Instagram, you know, half an hour into my writing day. It just destroys that concentration and that sort of entry into on another plane of existence, which is what creativity requires of you, I think.
It's a very good way of phrasing it to say, if I'm going to write books, then I have to X, because I haven't found a way of articulating this problem for myself in a way that is that clear cut. Like, I'm quite good at, like, I've lost quite a lot of weight during the pandemic because I made a decision at the beginning of the year that either I was going to get fat and, you know, watch Netflix through the pandemic, or I was going to do something more constructive. So my thinking to myself was, you know, if I want to live a long, healthy life and see my kids get married someday and be, you know, and feel alive and active, then I can't just eat whatever I want, whenever I want, and never exercise. And that was an easy switch that flicked. And yet on the sort of the temptation of always eating the lolly of digital distraction, I haven't found a way to put that in a context where the long-term sort of aspiration, or not even aspiration, just the simple blunt reality of if I'm going to write books, or if I'm going to do X, yeah. or if I'm going to survive, or if I'm going to this, then as a logical necessity, it's almost a syllogism, like I have to make, I have to get
yeah.
some structure.
Something
around,
has to give.
Something has to give. I've got to get my arms around this problem.
And I think you're in a more difficult situation, because when you work in the media or in, you know, podcasting or whatever, you feel like, well, I have to be on top of all these other things. Mm. I have to be. And I used to feel like that about Twitter. And when I said I was deleting my Twitter account, I got all these messages from people saying, oh, it's a real mistake. You know, you're really going to, your career is really going to suffer because people won't know that you're out there, blah, blah, blah. My books got better. I started. I certainly sold a lot more books once I got off Twitter. Now, those things are clearly not directly related, but getting focus is just crucial. And I think it is hard when you're in journalism or in you know, broadcasting of any kind. You know, you can feel that it's essential that you have your finger on the pulse all the time.
Yeah.
But I would suggest that could work exactly in the opposite way. It could just fill up your space in your mind with junk and not mm-hmm. allow you to come up with original ideas or deeply thought, you know, ideas for projects. So I think, you know, if I was working in journalism or some more public world, I would have to work out a way of really quarantining my time and space to really protect it, to allow that stillness to come in. Mm. Because I feel like the stillness, I think I said in that early piece, it's not a void, it's a well. You know, it will fill itself with interesting things if you don't block it all up with, you know, stuff from the outside world all the time.
Yeah.
So I think it's, you know, as you say, that the devices are designed to take you away from your own inner stillness. That's their job.
I mean, the other thing that they do, and you just sort of touched on it a bit, is they make you much more predictable, because the way yeah. they're a kind of reward feedback system. So you get stuck in these little loops of what's going viral or what is the most likely to create engagement, which means, you know, what are people most likely to share, comment on, or like? So things that rile people up or things that reinforce their beliefs. So it just makes one much less innovative, because you're following these little looping trends as they feed back on themselves, instead of finding what is truly unusual or inspiring in the cosmos to try to share with other people.
Also, you, one of the reasons I quit Twitter was I became so hyper-conscious of what other people would think of what I was doing. So if I write a sentence, I could think of 10 people on Twitter who would go, oh, can you believe she wrote that? You know, even if clearly it was only my imagination, but that having a constant torrent of other people's opinions about every single thing that happens in the world, whether it's someone's dress or their speech or their book or their anything, you know, the way they looked at someone in a press conference, that sort of constant opinionating I found really draining on my own sense of judgment about what I was doing. I had to just, and I also hated my own voice on Twitter. It was like, had to be a bit sort of, you know, a bit sarcastic, but a bit, we had to be witty and you had to be thoughtful and you had to, it was a kind of performance for me in the end. And I just felt sick at the way my own thoughts were colonized by what other people were going to think of every word I said. So getting away from that was just this enormous relief. And I'm not trying to sound, you know, I mean, I can do the same thing on Instagram, so it's not Twitter's fault, but it was my own losing a sense of what Rosalie Gascoigne talked about in, she said, when I put up a show of her art, she said, all it has to be is self-respecting. And what other people think is, you know, neither here nor there. And so for me, the more time I spend online, the the less I am able to know what is self-respecting in my work. I have to be by myself quietly to go, yes, that's right, or no, that's not good enough, or whatever. And then, you know, then you come out and you show, you know, people before it's finished and what they think and blah, blah. But that sense of needing to nurture your own original thoughts quietly until they're sturdy enough to kind of to withstand, you know, critique and scrutiny from the outside world. I just think that for me it has to be done away from the outside world.
When you say self-respecting is a great way of putting it, isn't it? And when you say that you didn't like your voice on Twitter, how did you find your voice in the first place when you started writing? How did you find what gave you self-respect?
In fiction, you mean, in books?
Yeah. Well, wherever you want to take that. I mean, when you're when you're an adolescent, just trying to forge a career in writing and find yourself.
Yeah, when I was at university, I started dabbling in it. Look, I feel like I wrote a few books before I found it, actually, and published a few books. But I guess when I finally realized that all I have to do is actually say what I think. I don't have to say what, like, it was kind of a revelation to me that when I wrote what I felt was true, in inverted commas, meaning that might be in a fictional sense, if it wasn't being pretentious or if it wasn't kind of always having an eye on what the response might be, if I actually focused on what I thought or what I saw in my imagination, then it becomes self-respecting. But if I was always sort of second-guessing, well, I can't write that because that sounds like so-and-so's book, or I can't write that because, you know, this writer I really admire wouldn't like that, or I can't do that because, you know, that kind of thing doesn't sell, blah, 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 all that stuff. That second-guessing just undermines any real substance that you have. And when I, you know, do occasional bits of teaching and stuff, I just say, just tell the truth. Tell the truth about yourself. And I don't mean write autobiography, but I mean, I've seen this happen in writers a lot, that your first book you write in this kind of naive innocence, where a lot of the time you don't think anyone's ever going to read it because you think it will never get published. And so you kind of are a bit more free to just do your own weird thing. So then that might get published and get noticed or not or whatever. But then you sort of become ashamed of what you've done because you realize that it's not like all the other proper books and proper writers. And so you spend the next while sort of running away from that as fast as you can to try and write something that you think other people will like or that will sell or that will bring you some respect or whatever. And you can get further and further away from the actual sort of true sense of who you are as an artist. And then I sort of, my theory is it's about three or four books in where people realize that that hasn't worked anyway. That didn't work to get you all the things you thought it was going to get you. And they become quite disillusioned. And then they go, you know what, I'm just going to do what I fucking want. And I don't care if nobody reads it. And then quite often that's the book that, you know, suddenly there's a response to, because they've given up on seeking approval because it never works. And then ironically, the thing that gets the approval is that, but then it's really hard to hold your nerve on that you know, approach to go, ooh, okay, that worked, so now I'll do it again. You know, like, I do think being really sincere in your sincerely expressing your own preoccupations, no matter whether other people think that's weird or boring or stupid, or I do think it's the only way to actually get any satisfaction out of being an artist. You can't guarantee anything except your own pleasure in the process. Once a book is published, it's almost none of your business what happens to it. And I think it's a mistake to try and control what happens to it up, you know, to sort of, well, certainly to go reading it, you know, looking at what people say on Goodreads and whatever is just a recipe for disaster. So I think you write your book or you make your, you know, ceramic pot or your podcast or whatever, you put it out there and then you go back to work. Because obsessively following whether anyone liked it or didn't like it or whatever, you know, I mean, I don't know about in podcasting, but I just think the genuine impulse.
Yeah. It's interesting. I once heard Conan O'Brien talking about his philosophy about his late night show, where he was saying he had to give himself some compassion about whether or not each show was going to be good, because he's such a perfectionist that if he wanted to do each show the way that he wants to do it, he'd never be able to do a show. So he thinks of each show as a piece of a mosaic, and by the end of his life, yeah, he will have produced this mosaic, and he doesn't know yet what the mosaic will look like, but, you know, he can't fret each piece too much, but just do the best job you can with the piece, and eventually all the pieces will fit together into something, and there'll be this thing.
I think that's exactly right, and I often talk with, you know, newer writers about the body of work. That's what you think about. So each book is going to be a different thing, and, you know, it might succeed or fail in whatever terms you decide equals success or failure. But the interesting thing will be the body of work at the, when you've written all the books you're going to write, what does it say about you? What have you discovered? And I do think that exploratory impulse is the thing to follow and focus on. Not what will the book be like, but what am I discovering? What interests me? What do I want to find out? What am I looking for my own interest? And often with me, it'll be sort of a form thing. Like it'll be, so say with my last novel, The Weekend, there was a very shifting point of view, which I hadn't done. So it was sort of technical stuff. And I can, you know, get a lot of satisfaction out of just trying that sort of stuff. And then, you know, yes, writing all the kind of, the content, for want of a better word, is one thing, but the way I do it is often what will sustain me through, you know, years of writing a book, tinkering with the form, and just learning how to do it. Learning, I do think looking at your work as, you know, people, I've often been surprised when I say, I feel like I'm just starting to learn how to write. And I've published, you know, have many, I don't know, 8 books or 9 books or something now. It's like, ah, I'm starting to get a handle on it, but only just, you know. And then it's interesting to keep doing it.
When you talk about, like, your preoccupations, express your own preoccupations, sometimes I think there's a creative people doubt whether or not their preoccupations are interesting because they're not being expressed by other people necessarily. Or maybe you focus on the preoccupations that you hear other people expressing, which you also share, because presumably those are universal because you've heard other people express them. And you don't want to express your weird little preoccupation that you've never heard anyone else express, because that by definition is non-universal. And that reminds me a bit of a piece of writing advice that I got from a writing coach in the States who said that you just have to remember that the specific is universal.
Yeah.
If you try to be universal, you'll end up being sort of pat and like unoriginal.
It's a generic.
Generic, exactly. If you talk about something that's universal, that's very, very, very specific to you, maybe no one else will have felt that exact thing, but because you're articulating so precisely a human experience, it'll resonate with them in some way.
Yeah, I think Chekhov said that in the particular is the universal.
Right. I'll just credit my American writing teacher with it and give Chekhov the short shrift.
Chekhov won't know.
He won't know. He's doing fine.
I've just forgotten what I was going to say. COVID brain is real.
That's all right. We can come back to that. That'll come up. What's your attitude towards your earlier work?
Oh, well, you know. I feel...
From that response, it doesn't sound like deep pride. Is there, like, you know, do you cringe a bit for your younger self or what?
Oh, I certainly cringe for my younger self. I feel the way I would looking at, you know, a young woman who's just out in the street, and I think, oh, you poor little thing, you'll be all right. You know, you don't have to try so hard. Look, I feel proud of them for what they are, but I, you know, you get better at your craft, you get better at, you get more confident. I mean, you still lose all of that every time you start a book, but I feel, you know, I think they're fine. And I haven't, you know, I certainly would never go back and reread them, for example. But every now and again, if I'm asked to read something from an old book, I do get a little surprised thinking, actually, that's not bad, you know, that I just, but I guess I'm always just looking forward. I'm not that interested in thinking about what I've done before, because I'm usually trying to work on something that I haven't done before. And often, as I said, that'll be sort of technical.
So you're not are you a nostalgic person? I mean, this also dovetails with The Weeknd, the book that you mentioned, which is about aging.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm nostalgic at all. I mean, I only realised recently that I just hate even thinking about the past. I don't know that that's a particularly good thing or a healthy thing, but I just, I'm not interested in it. And I'm not nostalgic in the, you know, I'm not sentimental about, I don't know, old photos or keeping stuff or whatever. I'd gladly chuck it all. So my husband and I are always having a sort of tussle about getting rid of stuff. And, you know, it's like, oh, somebody gave you this. I'm like, yeah, but you don't want it, so who cares? I don't think I'm nostalgic.
There's a word, I think, in Japanese that means the anticipation of future nostalgia towards something that you're going through now. And I am constantly feeling that because I have toddlers. And so amid the sleeplessness and stress and anxiety of the pandemic and parenting, I am constantly told by parents of older children or grandparents, you know, cherish these moments, you know, they go by so fast, kids grow up so quickly. This is the, you know, the moment of your life that you're going to wish you could revisit. Don't be on your phone while they're playing with each other at the playground, because you'll give all of the king's, you know, gold to be able to parachute back into your skin right now in 20 years time and watch them and cuddle them and hug them and pick their brains for thoughts. And yet that's not the experience of most parents with toddlers. I mean, most parents with toddlers are focused on, you know, getting them dressed and ushering them out the door and taking care of all of the things that need to be taken care of in daily life. And so I'm keenly aware, like, that I'm living in a dreamscape that my future self, hopefully, assuming I live that long, will look back on with a deep sense of nostalgia. And yet I can't quite muster that rose hue.
Well, it's
right now.
It takes energy, right, to do that. I mean, that's a kind of mindfulness thing, isn't it? To say, appreciate this moment, whether it's with your kids at the park or, I don't know, eating an apple or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's hard because we are so conditioned to think about the future or the past, you know, that sort of anticipating or ruminating. And especially the future, I guess.
Well, maybe especially the future for you, but there are other people who live entirely in the past. Recrimination, regret, you know, could have been, would have been, should have done this, should have done that. Yes, and then others who feel constant anxiety about what will come. Where do you live time-wise, and how do you cultivate a connection with the present?
I mean, the biggest thing that I can do, not that I do always do it, is just turn off the technology, get offline, basically. Get offline. But I had a little rule for myself through the lockdown of every day, and I haven't done it every day, but I'm trying to. Every day I have to go analog and outside. So get outside as much as possible. I've got a tiny, tiny little sort of pocket garden, courtyard garden, which I am so incredibly grateful for during this time, because I'm doing this kind of micro gardening. You know, I can look at every damn leaf in that garden now and know what it's doing. But for me, those things, doing things like cooking, gardening, reading, but probably the things that have really kept me sane during the lockdown have been the cooking and the gardening and doing stuff that's physical. I too, you know, we bought an exercise bike, especially because I'm doing so much bloody baking that I've never done before. So it's like, if I'm going to make, you know, biscuits five times a week, I've got to get on the exercise bike five times a week. But I think that being online too much is really, really destructive for me personally. Not just because of the distraction, but it feels like I'm eating too much sugar, you know, when I'm just scrolling endlessly out of boredom, and then it really destroys my concentration for reading properly.
Mm.
It does something bad to my concentration, which is already skew if enough because of COVID. Just like that kind of hyper vigilance and hyper anxiety and everything about. I mean, I feel like you can walk out the door and you can feel anxiety, not so much in these last couple of weeks, but when things were really just zooming upwards in the numbers, there was a lot of tension just in the air. So,
yeah, no, that's gone.
Analog and outside is my mantra.
That concentration, I mean, gee, you know, I found it hard to read long fiction, I got to say. I'm ashamed to admit that my ability to... I haven't finished a novel since the pandemic began. And I, the other day, I had a half day without the kids because my partner was taking them out, and I thought, I'm going to sit down and watch a movie. I'm going to watch, like, The Godfather Part 2, like a big classic movie that I have somehow never gotten around to seeing. And even that was hard. Like 40 minutes in, I'm reaching for my phone for no reason at all, because my consciousness, my concentration has been fragmented into these. There's a great quote by the guy who wrote Deep Work, Cal Newport, who I assume it's a guy, could be a woman, who says that social media has fragmented time into shards too small to construct a meaningful life out of, because that, you know, shards too small to have the self-reflection that's necessary and the sense of purpose that's necessary to construct a meaningful life. So, you know, this can be the last moment that we bang on about how bad social media is, but I am noticing, if I'm noticing this in me, who normally has a pretty good focus, then what's the consequence for society and culture of an entire population being unable to digest long, complicated, deep ideas?
Yeah, or just sit there, you know, and I mean, reading requires you to go into that still space that I talked about at the beginning. That's what reading is, you know. It's no surprise that it's, you know, no one can read at the moment or read anything beyond. And also, you know, there's a kind of rise of novels that are written in little fragmented, I think Delia Falconer calls it bricks of text. It's not even paragraphs anymore. They're just sort of a little fragmented lump and then space and then another dissociated lump of text and a space.
Really?
And I think what that sort of, speaks
this
to...
This has passed me by. What is that?
Well, there's a whole bunch of books like Jenny Offal's book, Weather. Of course, there's books that I've been obsessively reading and rereading through the pandemic, Deborah Levy's books, The Cost of Living and Real Estate, which are, you know, almost sort of diary style. And they're great, but I think there is a move away from the sort of big solid narrative now, and it's a sign of how fragmented we feel at the moment. And that's not a bad thing. I mean, novels are there to express the culture, you know. So But I do think, I wonder if there'll be a backlash against those kinds of books sometime soon, whether we'll go back to the big, you know, Hilary Mantel style tome.
I certainly hope so. I hope so. Who were your heroes when you were younger? What made you want to do what you did?
They were writers. My early sort of model writer, Kate Grenville, was a huge hero of mine. And my writing heroes sort of change all the time. I mean, I feel like I'm quite a skittish kind of person, really, in lots of ways. And so whatever book I'm working on, I have a new sort of model. At the moment, I think it probably would be Deborah Levy. But in Australia, people like Helen Garner was a great sort of guide. Not that she ever knew about it. you know, women novelists who were writing sort of contemporary fiction, who were just writing about, you know, the worlds they lived in, really meant a lot to me. And then recently I've moved more towards other art forms as sort of models or influencers, I guess. So visual artists a lot. A visual artist, I really look at their work and it helps me make my work. But they sort of change all the time. I'm trying to think when I was growing up. So long ago, can't remember.
You grew up in the Snowies, did you? You were born in Cooma?
I was. My dad worked for the Snowy Mountains Scheme.
That was a huge hydroelectric nation-building project for non-Australians.
Yeah, it was. It was a very big – I feel like it was built in this kind of innocence where it was just this grand heroic kind of idea, whereas now I would not feel like that about hydroelectric schemes at all.
No. Think about maybe American listeners might think of the Hoover Dam or something like that as being the hydroelectric, the Snowy River Scheme.
But it was kind of interesting country town to grow up in because it was a very small place, but it had a much more kind of multicultural population compared to most Australian country towns, I think, because of all the immigrant workers who came to build the Snowy Mountain Scheme.
Right.
So it was, I mean, not that you know, the grand cultural mix was actually celebrated or anything, of course, because it was Australia. It was sort of like, oh, let's pretend that we're all white. They were mostly Northern European, so they, you know, they were white. But I had a really great childhood, actually. It was very free.
What's your relationship to Cooma and that part of the world now?
Well, I don't have a very strong relationship. My parents both died quite young, so I don't have family there or anything anymore. And I haven't been back much, but I do have some friends still on farms. And so when I left school, I worked on the local newspaper and I hung out with lots of nice people lots of farmers, and it was probably the main thing that people I knew did. So I still have friends there, but I don't go back there very much just because my family sort of all left there, really.
What was the impact of your parents dying young? How young were you?
I was 19 when my father died, and I was 29 when my mother died. And I had left by then, but then went back when she was sick. It was very catastrophic, really. I think for anyone to lose a parent when they're relatively young, it defines your whole life, really. I mean, I was 19. My younger sister was 13 when Dad died. So that was, I think, really... You know, if I think now of my many nephews and nieces, even the ones in their 30s, I think, Well, it's they couldn't lose their parents. That would not be tolerable.
Yeah.
So I guess, but I also think I don't know that I'd be writing if my parents had lived, which is a weird thing to say. But after my mother died, I'd always liked writing. I'd always loved reading more than anything. And then I sort of dabbled in writing at university after my dad had died and my mum was still alive. And I did writing classes and I really liked it, but I didn't really take it very seriously. And then once my mother died, I had that feeling that lots of people will recognize after a sort of, big event like that, where life separated really clearly into important things and unimportant things.
Right.
And I knew immediately that writing was important to me and I wanted to commit to it and do something with it, not just sort of think, oh, one day I'll get around to that. Because I also thought life is short. I know now life is very short. I'm now 3 years older than my father was when he died and a couple of years off. My mum was 58, so in a couple of years I'll be her age. And to me now that feels, I've always thought life is very short, so I have to just do what I want to do because I still feel that way, that I think I've probably had a consciousness of death from younger age than lots of people do. And it hasn't been a terrible thing. It was a terrible thing to lose our parents, but being that aware of how short life is, I think is a really good thing because it means that I tend not to dick around.
I just
think if I want to do something, do it now because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
It's amazing how removed most of us are from that instinct. I'm glad to hear you say it. There's an app that someone has produced that pings you with notifications at random intervals telling you how many weeks you have left to live if you live the normal life expectancy.
I think I could do without that.
And there's
only like 4,000 hours or something that you...
Yeah, yeah.
That's not enough.
No, it's not hours. It's
days.
4,000 weeks, I think.
See, there you go. That's my 4,000 hours.
4,000 hours is very much, Charlotte.
probably, I actually am dead. I didn't realize.
You should listen to, it's 4,000 weeks. Actually, the only person who's been on this podcast twice is the author of the book 4,000 Weeks, Oliver Berkman.
I love him.
Is wonderful. You read
the book about optimism that he...
Yeah, happiness for people who can't stand positive thinking. Oh, The Antidote, that was the subtitle.
The Antidote, that's right, yeah. I thought he was great.
Yeah, Berkman, listen to Berkman's two episodes of this because he's very good about that. And there's also, in addition to the app, there's a company that produces a poster for your room it's a grid with little dots, with little squares on it, and each square represents, I think, a week or is it a day? And it's a whole block of squares that total the average life expectancy, and it's shaded in where you are, where you're up to.
Oh my God.
On that.
Well, see, that could be great, and it could also be the opposite of what you need. Like that thing that I was talking about before about entering into a sense of stillness and not producing madly all the time, I guess, not filling yourself up, but also not thinking, right, I've got to do this many books and this many podcasts. And, if I'm not achieving in that mad way, then that's not good for your sense of creativity either. Like I think that you need the ability to squander time.
Right.
And to do nothing. I'm really bad at doing nothing. But years ago I wrote a book called The Writer's Room. It's a collection of interviews that I did with other writers. And the writer Joan London, who I absolutely love, West Australian writer, she really seemed to embody to me the idea that you allow your work to come. And I was like, oh, I thought you had to wrestle it to the ground and right. just punch yeah. it into life. Yeah. So the kind of sense of letting go of the need to control things. And when I have really gotten in the right rhythm to do that, it really works, where a book will start to tell you how to write it if you just kind of let go of the reins enough and stop trying to, will it into existence. If you mm-hmm. just allow it to come rather than forcing it to come, that is a whole different
thing. It's beautiful to hear you say that, because that also what you're pointing to with regards to creativity has a parallel that Oliver Berkman points to with regards to happiness, which is that if you make it the end goal, if you try to chase after it too hard, if you squeeze the soap too hard, it slips out of your hand. Like, there's a certain deftness and lightness of touch that's necessary to allow it
Absolutely.
To come to you. That happiness should be a byproduct of doing other things. And in the same way, maybe creativity is a byproduct of getting in touch with something that doesn't necessarily feel like creativity at the time.
I think that's right, and I'm just sort of remembered what I was going to say before when I lost my thread. It was about right. energy and following a spark of energy. And in the book, I did a PhD a few years ago and looking at cognitive processes of creativity, and the kind of main sort of mechanism or way of thinking that I discovered in this little study I did was, I called it heat seeking. And it was about just learning how to recognize when you feel a kind of pull towards something, even if it makes no sense at all. You follow that heat, and that's how you end up producing a work of art and or anything, any other form of creativity where you are. And it's an exploratory kind of questing thing. It's not, I have something to say and I'm going to, give it to the world. It is, I want to find out something. What is this weird little, so the heat in a writing sense might be an image that doesn't even really make sense, but you just keep thinking about it. Your mind keeps returning to it. Or it might be a question about, say, in the weekend, I think one of the things that propelled that book was my question about, is it possible to have a really living friendship for 40 or 50 years? And how? If that is possible, then how is it possible? As people change and so on, and let each other change or not. So that might be the bit of heat that I followed. Or it could be just anything that is the little nugget that you, the creator, is interested in. But quite often you think, oh, nobody else will care about that, so I'll just abandon it. But I feel very strongly that you shouldn't abandon that thing, because that's your little bit of gold. That's what's going to allow you to stick with a project. When you write books, they take a long time. So you need to have some interest and spark of energy that will keep you going through the long years of making a book.
It sounds like you're talking about two different instincts here. One is being receptive enough to the muse, for want of a better word, to allow yourself to hear what it is that needs to be said sort of almost through you, like you're talking about allowing the work to come. And then on the other hand, you're also talking about a project of exploration where you're trying to pursue a theme like a 40-year-long friendship. Are they a yin and yang? Are they opposites, being receptive to and being curious, or are they the same thing?
Well, there's two. What I found in this study that I did, in the research I did for that, was looking at a whole lot of creativity research, and one very well sort of documented model is, I think it's called dual process theory. It's about two different kinds of thinking. So it's divergent thinking and convergent thinking. And so the divergent thinking is the kind of loose, associative, intuitive, dreamy, unconscious mind. And I think it's really important for artists and creative people to really pay attention to that intuitive, the hunch, the thing that doesn't make any sense, but you still keep going back to it. So there's that. That, to me, is where the heat comes from that I was just talking about. Mm. Those little things that don't make sense, but they snag your interest and you keep they keep coming into your mind. And I feel like those things come into your mind for a reason. They're there to show you the way forward in your book or your, ceramic pot or whatever it is. But then after a certain point, you have to use the other kind of thinking, the much more pragmatic, logical, conscious thought, the convergent thinking, where you start to narrow. So the first, the divergent thinking is very open form of thinking, and then after a while you need to start narrowing it and shaping it, and that's where, as a novelist, the craft comes in, the pacing and the structure and all that sort of stuff. But I can't do that pacing and structuring and craft stuff and editing until I've got a certain level of mass of the dreamy, loose, imagistic, associative thinking that has yielded just kind of lumps of unrelated stuff.
Mm.
Not making it sound very clear, but
no,
and it's really unclear. That early process I find quite frightening, because it's very uncertain. You live in a state of unknowing, and that's why it's not comfortable, And I think that's why we turn to, Twitter or whatever, to fill up that uncertain space. But if you're going to make art, you need to accept that you are living between certainties all the time. That's what it is to be an artist.
Mm. How much do you structure? Like, my only experience with writing is in script writing, and you would almost always do a beat sheet before you wrote anything of what is going to happen. I don't know how a novel gets written. How do you wrestle those ideas to the ground before you put pen to paper?
Well, I think script writing is incredibly disciplined in that way. Like, you can't, from what I understand, I've never written a script, but you have to have all that stuff, that structural stuff, in place sort of right from the beginning, right?
Mm.
Whereas I can write a novel for 3 years just throwing stuff away, just writing scenes. I mean, I feel like the novel that I'm writing now, I've had about 5 false starts on because of COVID. It takes me ages, for example, to find the voice, and then the voice will be the thing that sort of pushes it along. But I might write 30,000 words and then throw out 25,000 of them. Because only a certain bit has this heat or energy that, so it's quite different, I think, from script writing. I mean, I think lots of novelists do work in a way that's much more aligned to the way that you would write a script, but I don't work like that. So it's a very hazy, amorphous, it's very frustrating, really, to be writing for 2 years not knowing if any of it's actually going anywhere. But then, you can feel the engine kicking into life, and often it takes a year of writing stuff that you know you're not going to use. But I have to write that in order to get to the bit that is going to, start the engine.
Mm. I once heard someone, a writer, say that they don't like writing, but they do love having written.
Oh, yeah.
Do you feel that way, or do you like writing?
No, I love having written. Look, I do. I like it when it's going well, but that's very, very rare. But I like it when I'm fully absorbed, and I have to always relearn this every week. Every time I sit down to write, I have to remember that. The pleasure only comes when you that, and you would know this, I'm sure, with a sense where time drops away, that
The flow state.
That sense of the flow state. So Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, that guy, the flow guy, he's one of my favorite dudes. And he, you know, that sense of being somewhere else and the work kind of coming through you. I've only had a really one very, very intense experience of that flow state. I've had sort of minor. I had one afternoon this time years ago where it was like I was on some other planet. It was unbelievable and amazing. Where I'd been, and I write about it in the book, in The Luminous Solution, where I had been really struggling to finish a novel. It just felt really lumpy and ungainly and I couldn't make it work. And anyway, I just worked away as you do. And then this one afternoon, I had this several hours of just feeling like I had the entire book in my head. I knew exactly what to do and exactly where to do it. I was changing things around. It was utterly effortless. It was, my brain was incredibly sharp. And I knew while it was happening, it was like, oh my God, this is really spooky. This is not normal. And it was, and almost I feel like every other bit of writing since then is an attempt to get back into that state because it was kind of transcendental in some way.
Let's talk about the spirituality of that then. What, like when you say you've got to allow the work to come, and when you allude to, if people haven't heard of the flow state and Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi, whatever his name is, I can never pronounce it correctly, then they can look up the book Flow, which is his classic text about it's about that state. It doesn't matter whether you're playing tennis, whether you're writing a book, whether you're, you know, whatever it is, when you're in a peak state of focus where everything else dissolves away and you're all that is in front of you is the task at hand. What is that? What do you make of that? Where is that coming from?
Well, I think it only comes when you've kind of earned it, which is annoying. I think it comes from a period of sustained attention, like really deep attention, and a practiced way of letting all the, you know, there's so many things that really interfere with creative thinking. And one study that I came across that I really loved and it changed my own approach to going into a writing day was a meta-analysis of 25 years of mood and creativity research. And that meta-analysis shows that there were kind of three elements that made up the most creative mood state according to the cognitive psychology research. And those three things were a positive affect, so, you know, just sort of a positive mood, happiness, or, you know, an up kind of mood. And they said a slightly elevated activation or energy level, so but only slightly elevated, so not super excited and not really totally zen, but just sort of a little bit anticipatory, you know, a little bit just slightly activated, as they say. Mm. And the third one was called a promotion focus, which meant focusing on the gains to come rather than avoiding pain. So I think they had a the analogy in the thing that I read was about a mouse seeking cheese or running away from a predator. You want the seeking cheese feeling, not the running away from the predator feeling. So I sort of had to really change my mindset about, because, you know, for me, the writing process has very often been filled with a lot of fear and anxiety. And what I discovered in reading this meta-analysis was that all the things that were my general mode of working, fear, anxiety, kind of agitation, sort of feeling quite gloomy about it, are the least creative mood state, according to this research. Mm. So what I started to do was try and sort of almost fake my way into changing my mood before I sat down to work. And the way that I sort of translated it in the end was to create a state of slightly excited, curious optimism. So instead of going to the desk thinking, oh God, I've got to write today and it's going to be awful because it won't be any good and it's too hard and I'd rather be outside doing something else. So just putting that to one side and instead going to the desk thinking, oh, I wonder what I'm going to find out today in my novel. I wonder what's going to happen. How interesting. Something cool is in there for me to find. And I did some of that with the help of a psychologist called Alison Manning, who has a sort of a boutique practice working with writers called A Mind of One's Own. And she, you know, really sort of helped me with this, I think she calls it state creation, where you just decide, I'm going to feel like this instead of like that. Now, of course, at the beginning, you feel like, oh, this is so hokey and it's not authentic. I don't feel like that. So it's just lying and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, in the end, it really helped me to be able to keep. That was especially when I was working on a book called The Natural Way of Things, which was a really dark story about misogyny, basically. So it was not a fun work to be hanging around in. But, and one thing Alison told me about getting to that flow state, getting back to your actual question, was about leaving outside the. So I sort of began to conceive of my going into my novel in progress as going into like a sort of circus tent, where if I left outside the tent, all the self-criticism and the fear and the doubt and the, you know, sort of self-flagellation, only if those things didn't come in with me could I go in and see this kind of amazing thing unfold. But if I brought all that other stuff in, nothing would happen. So it was a lot of kind of visualization stuff, and but it really, really helped me write that book particularly. It really actually made it possible to write that book.
It's amazing that we need that when, you know, you've experienced flow, you've had those moments of pure transcendence when you're writing. You know that the only doorway to get there, to get that cheese, is through the door of sitting your bum down in a chair and starting to write. And yet there's tremendous resistance to just sit down and write. You know, you do feel like, if you're not paying a psychologist to help you think about things in a different way, then the default state for the creative person is to feel like the mouse running away from the predator, not the mouse going towards the cheese, even though a million times in a row you know that sitting down to do the work is the pathway towards the cheese.
It's mad. Why?
I don't know. You're the expert. I was hoping you could answer it.
I honestly don't. Like, it's a marvel to me that it's still... It's so hard to...
Like, what are we afraid of? There's, you know.
Well, I think Stephen we're Pressfield afraid of that. Go on.
Sorry, I was just going to say, Stephen Pressfield in, you know, The War of Art, his classic little handy book about writing, sort of calls it resistance with a capital R and invokes it as almost a demon or a phenomenon that exists in the world that you have to constantly be fighting against. But, I mean, that doesn't make a lot of ontological sense to me, but it resonates with me emotionally.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it resonates with me emotionally too. I think it's partially the fear of that stillness, because you can sit there, you know, it's plenty of times I've sat at the desk and nothing has happened. You know, it's so it's a, and I think before you talked about perfectionism, and that is an absolute killer, that will ruin everything. To think, well, I can't, and I think a lot of procrastination and this sort of thing is about perfectionism.
Yeah,
it's a feeling that, well, if I sit down at the desk, it's not going to be perfect, so I don't want to do it. You know, whereas, you know, I actually came to accept fairly early on that I would never write the book that I really wanted as good as I really wanted it to be. But I do think I've learned that you can get better. You know, that it's talent isn't a fixed, it's not a fixed quantity of something. You either have it or you don't. You can develop your talent. You can explore your talent. You can grow it. But so I think the fear thing, again, is about the fear of stillness. It's about the fear of failure. And our whole culture absolutely hammers into us that failure is not acceptable. So 90% of my time at the desk is failure. You know, most of the stuff I write, I throw away because it hasn't worked. But I have to write that stuff to get to the stuff that does work. So if we were a lot more accepting of failure as a culture, I don't think there would be the amount of fear around, you know, just making stuff.
Yeah.
That's why I like making food, because, you know, half the time it doesn't work, but who cares? You can still eat it. It doesn't. And
if
actually,
you can't, you can order in, you know, someone else will make something for you. You can throw it out.
But what you discover in cooking is it almost never is actually inedible. You might screw it up, but it means it just tastes different. It doesn't, it doesn't look like the picture, but it tastes great. So there's no sense of, you know, when I'm cooking or gardening, I don't have that sense of, oh, this has got to be good enough for, you know, the world to look at. It's just got to be good enough for me to look at.
Yeah.
And experience. And I think if you can take that attitude into stuff that you make professionally, and as you said, the Conan O'Brien thing about the mosaic, I love that. The body of work, that's what's interesting.
There's something about taking, I'm just trying to articulate, I'm trying to put my finger on what the feeling is for me when I sit down to write something and don't and get distracted. And it's not exclusively a fear of not producing the work that I wish that I could. Perfectionism's part of it, but, you know, obviously the work that's in your head that doesn't exist is perfect. The one on the page is despoiled and falls short of what you're capable of in your own brain. But there's also a sense of self-judgment, or the little creature on your shoulder worrying that you're not putting out the what you should be putting out, or that other people are gonna judge it. And the solution to that, or the remedy there, is just, I find, to do the time, to frame it. And this is, I suppose, related to the mosaic analogy, but like, all you can do is sit your ass down in a chair for 4 hours a day, or 2 hours a day, or 30 minutes a day, or whatever you've given yourself. I think it was Stephen King, actually, I interviewed Stephen King when I was in New York working, and he had been a hero of mine in my teens. And, you know, we sort of got deep into this kind of stuff. And he was like, at the end of the day, if you sit down in front of a computer and you allow that cursor to blink, then something's going to happen. You know, if you don't do anything else, that's fine. Yeah. You can sit there and not write if you want. But the great challenge of writing is not the writing. The great challenge of writing is carving out that time where you do nothing except for sit in front of the cursor.
Yeah. Look, I do think that pragmatism, I've got a chapter in the book called Cat and Baby, which makes sense when you read it, but on intuition versus pragmatism. And I said in that for long periods of a book's development, the pragmatist is the person who keeps the thing on the rails. You know, all that lovely, dreamy, unconscious stuff I love, but that doesn't get a book written. What gets a book written is turning up and sitting your ass in the chair and trusting in hard work and grit and discipline and routine, you know, all the kind of unsexy stuff. But a lot of the time, that's what gets the work done. I would argue that the other stuff is what gives the work pleasure. But you need to, I certainly need to be prepared to just stick with it, just literally just persevere. And sometimes in writing classes, students have, you know, said, well, how do you know if you've got enough talent? And I'm like, well, you don't. You never will know. But also, talent is not what lets you go the distance. It's actually the perseverance and the determination and the tenacity, because those things will let you grow your talent. If you don't have the sort of really just really firm commitment, and also make little goals, you know, like when I first took writing seriously properly, and I went to writing classes, and I thought, all I want to do is finish something. That was, it wasn't like I'm going to be a writer and I'm going to be great or anything. It was just, I'm going to finish something. And that was really exciting then, because like, well, that was a really achievable goal to have, just finish something. And then when I finished it, it's like, okay, now I'm going to send it out to someone. And, yeah. You know, but I think a lot of the time people start out in a creative field thinking, I want to be a great screenwriter. And I sort of think, well, you're kind of doomed to fail if that is your only, you know, you need
to. It's a pretty daunting task. Yeah, it's on the to-do list. Like, I got to get some more bread. I got to, you know, enroll the kids in swimming classes, and I got to be the greatest screenwriter who ever lived.
Yeah. But if you thought, I'm going to do a year's worth of screenwriting classes, you know, that's good. That'll get you.
Or write one page, or just sit down for an hour. You mentioned earlier, we can wrap up here, Charlotte, but you were talking about how short life is, and how that has, how the fate of your parents has given you an appreciation for that. Does that, how do you think about your life and longevity? Do you fear death?
I would love to say I don't fear death. Of course I fear death. I fear death. I don't fear being dead, but I don't want to die. But I want to be ready to die. That's what I want. Mm. I want to be, you know, I feel like the point of living is to be ready to die when you die. So that if I died tomorrow, I would think I've done what I want to do with my life. You know, I'm married to a really fantastic person. I've got a very beautiful family and friends. I've written a bunch of books, and that's enough. I've seen people dying close up several times in terms of, you know, over a period of months, and I've been kind of staggered by their acceptance and their generosity. There's a chapter in my book about the writer Georgia Blaine, who's a friend of mine and a very, very beloved writer in Australia, and she died in 2016, and she was my age. And talking to her about her approaching death was the most profound experience, one of the most, certainly one of the most profound conversations I'd ever had, because she kept saying how lucky she felt that she had a lot of terrible things happen in her life, but she said, I'm lucky, I've had this amazing life, and I'm, you know, she was ready. I found that staggering. So if I could get to that point, I'd be happy.
The fact that we get to be here at all is worth remembering that we're lucky, lucky for.
Absolutely.
The universe could easily have gone on without our presence at all. Charlotte, it's terrific to talk to you. Thanks for your time. The new book is
Thanks, Josh.
Luminous Solution, Creativity, Resilience and the Inner Life. Let's look forward to being able to go out and have some outer life outside of lockdown as well. But in the meantime, I can't wait to read the book. And thanks again.
Thanks so much, Josh. Thanks a lot for having me.